is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society's new concert season, which runs September of 2018 through May of 2019. The Portland Folk Music Society is pleased to present a lineup of national and regional artists, including Molly O'Brien and Rich Moore, the Kathy Kallick Band, the Honey Whiskey Trio, Legends of the Celtic Harp with Patrick Ball, True North, Tish Hinojosa, Pat Donahue, Nina Gerber and Chris Webster, and Dave Stamey. For a limited time, the Portland Folk Music Society is offering a season ticket package at a deep discount from regular pricing, but this opportunity runs only through the end of May. For more information, go to kboo.fm, and on the right side of the homepage, click under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Welcome to Poetry and Everything. Good evening, folks. I'm Judith Arcana, your host. Each month, we open with me reading a bit of my own work. Then the guest and I read work by other poets. Then the guest does a reading for all of you. And then we just go on talking about poetry and everything. This year, 2018, is KBOO's 50th anniversary. I know, it's staggering, it's amazing, it's pretty wonderful. And if you're listening in Portland, Oregon, you should check out the History Society on the park blocks, because they have this amazing exhibit of the 50 years of KBOO's history. If you're listening somewhere else, you should come and visit before the end of the summer, because it's going to still run for several more months. All right, so this month, the one that I have chosen, This Is My Own Work poem, is called For All the Other Dances, I Was Perfect. And this piece just came out in an anthology from Slippery Rock University, from the literature folks there. The anthology, which is they do every year, is called Slab. Okay, For All the Other Dances, I Was Perfect. That's what I heard a young girl say to her father as we passed each other in the doorway at Hot Lips Pizza. Going out, I was push. Coming in, they were pull. So it worked nicely, went quickly, and that's all I heard. I didn't hear the father's answer, which, if she were my child, would have been something like, hey, great, perfect is good, can't get any better than that. I thought the man was her father. Maybe he wasn't. I thought, because it was 6 o'clock on a Friday, that he was divorced from her mother and had picked her up for the weekend, which would start with pizza, a classic divorced dad opener. But maybe her mom, his wife still, was in the car with the baby or the rescue dog or both of them. Or maybe her mom was at home, the home they all lived in together, making salad to go with the pizza when they brought it home. That could happen. Then, walking on, I thought, what if she said answers, not dances? What if she said, for all the other answers, I was perfect? What if it was a math test, not her dance class, in which various colorful costumes would be worn at the big recital coming up at the end of the month, halfway between Mother's Day and Father's Day, just as the girl would be between them, always, if I was right the first time. For all the other dances, I was perfect. And now that I'm done reciting, reading at you, your host, I am happy to introduce our guest, Jessica Mehta. She is a poet and novelist. Jessica was born and raised in Oregon. She's a member of the Cherokee Nation. Jessica has written 10 books and has received a Barbara Deming Memorial Fund Award grant in poetry and a Potlatch Award grant for Native artists, as well as various poet-in-residency awards, including the Hosking Houses Trust, with an appointment at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust in Stratford-upon-Avon, in England. That's in England, yes, we know that, we poetry people. And Paris Lit Up in France. Jessica is associate poetry editor for Bending Genres magazine and founder of the Get It Om Karma Yoga movement, which I take delight in even just reading, and we'll talk about a bit later. You can visit Jessica's author website online for more information. So, welcome, Jessica.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
A pleasure. A pleasure. So, let's do the other poet's work. What did you bring? Tell our folks listening what you've got.
I have two poems, one by John Boisvert and one by Kelly Terwilliger, both Oregon poets. Let's start with John's. And I kind of knew, even before I read it, that this would probably be the one. It's titled Virgin. I'm a confessional poet, so I can't help it. Virgin. I turn 13 this year, and everyone says I'm the next sacrifice. They begin planning the ceremony, holding auditions for who will sound the gong, who will tie my limbs. That morning, I beat the dirt and scream, "Why are you doing this?" "The queen of monsters will enjoy this one," they say. "I wish you were all dead," I yell. Then they tie my arms for real and start dancing. Then the monster queen comes and unties me. "I hate them," I tell her as she carries me into the forest. "I hate my parents." But she just pets me until my hair comes out. She pets me until I am old like them.
All right. And?
And Kelly Terwilliger's Elegy. A man who gives up might think he is leaving the world simpler, but he sets his beasts among us. They wander out at twilight, a scattering of ordinary leaves, rustling with the same dry sound they have always made this time of year. And the wind moves through the trees, a grandfather ruffling the heads of children bent over books, in which tigers and lions and bears step out of dreams and walk the streets. And the wind strokes their fur, which is soft, like the fur of rabbits, and full of a secret light that stays on your hands long after you have touched it. In the story, the animals are never hungry for more than a little cake. They climb into the zookeeper's bed, wanting only to be closer to human. We feel them nestled around us, breathing as we breathe. But now it is run and dive and lunge, alarm as real as gravel and tires driving into the hard, wet night. The highway roars, the rain refracts each beam of light into passing chrysanthemums, dying red and white and red and white. A long, dark cat skims shadows. A monkey climbs higher in the trees. They must be shot before they go too far, before they escape what we imagine them to be. I love good, strong ending lines.
Yes, and we all hope we write them. Yes. Absolutely, you betcha. I've got, I have to ask, is the Terwilliger poet of the family that the Terwilliger stuff in Oregon is named for?
You know, I don't know.
Because as soon as you said it, I thought, oh, this is the road. This is the, you know. Well, we'll find out. Okay, I chose... a poem by Ji Leong Ko, whose work is pretty much around, you know, not hard to find. A man who was born and raised in Singapore considers himself a Chinese person who writes in English. That's his phrase. This is called Attribution, and it begins with an epigraph that he chose from Evan Boland from her collection, The Mother Tongue. Her line is, "I speak with the forked tongue of colony." Attribution by Ji Leong Ko. My grandfather said life was better under the British. He was a man who begrudged his words, but he did say this. I was born after the British left an alphabet in my house, the same book they left in school. I was good in English. I was the only one in class who knew bedridden does not mean lazy. I was so good in English, they sent me to England, where I proved my grandfather right, until I was almost sent down for plagiarism I knew was wrong and did not know was wrong, because where I came from, everyone plagiarized. I learned to attribute everything I wrote. It is not easy. Sometimes I cannot find out who first wrote the words I wrote. Sometimes I think I wrote the words I wrote with such delight. Often the words I write have confusing beginnings, and none can tell what belongs to the British, my grandfather, or me. He's good, don't you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you for me.
All right. So, folks, if you've just tuned in, you missed some good stuff already, but because this show will be online, you'll be able to go back and get it. This is KBOO, Portland Community Radio. And now we're going to have a reading from Jessica Mehta. Read to us, please, madam.
Well, now that you led with that, I will read something out of order that I wrote in and about England when I was there.
Okay.
Everything is true that I write. This is a consenting platypus. The septuagenarian served me tea in the garden of her thatched roof British cottage. Between spoons of fish pie and too much Prosecco, I told her about the best-selling erotica I ghostwrite, how people don't like sex until at least chapter 19. She asked me about bestiality, which of us animals are the nastiest. No, incest and animals are my hard lines. That's too bad, she demurred. It's incredible what one can do with a consenting platypus. And she told me the name of that book, but I will never read it. This is Savagery, which is also the title poem of an upcoming book in 2019. What are you? I can see the Indian in your cheekbones. My skin, white as the albumen on salmon, the only whisper of Cherokee etched into the bones begging to be birthed. Show me your tribal card, your ancestry lineage, proof of Dawes rolls in your blood. Am I not native enough for you? You look like something, savaged and uncontained.
Mm. That line, you look like something. I know people actually say that.
That's actually, You Look Something is the title of a novel releasing in September of mine.
All right.
It's just all linked here.
Okay. Yes, we're going to get the prose and the poetry.
So this is A Priest and an Indian Walk into a Bar. Also from my summer in England. The priest cooked me risotto while I tongued olives and dry wine. Barefoot and drunk, we compared best sad operas and stumbled through yoga poses in the gloaming. After, giggling like schoolchildren through the buzz, sidling up to a bar, bellowing for bourbon and crushed ice. Fill it all the way up. We danced to ABBA and my skirt fell down, but I never once thought to confess more than was settled or ask anything close to forgiveness. This is How to Talk to the Dying. I looked up what to say to the dying because words get stuck in my hands. There's no good answers. You died the same way our father did, yellow skin and lion eyes. What do you say to your sister out on the reservation? I love you, that's it. Your husband told me you smiled and poured your own love you back into me all the way down through the wires. The voice deep, dark, and foreign, like a stranger's always is. While Zizobra burns, and I didn't know who Zizobra was until I spent time in Santa Fe, but he's the original Burning Man, a huge stick effigy that truly millions come to watch burn, and you stuff your woes written on paper inside him and watch it burn together. My first night in Santa Fe, I walked for hours, lost in adobe mazes. Parking lots were punctuated with hatch green chilies tumbling in iron cages while dusty sedans stood guard. Indigenous red suns rested on fields of yellow, and for once a native man told me I was beautiful. Say something about her hips, his friend with accent thick as Pinocho whispered. Esas caderas, but you shook those oiled braids like whip snakes, and we matched smiles over mesa cheekbones. Ashes from the burned stick man built nests in our plates, and I licked charred woes from strangers off my sun-cracked lips as the big white cross guided me home.
Have you gone more than once to the Burning Man thing? Is that?
No. But the entire experience in Santa Fe was truly magical.
Yeah, well, it's Santa Fe. Yes. All the whole top half of the state of New Mexico, I think, is a grand place to visit.
I'm going back. I was fortunate to do a little road trip afterwards, so I saw some of that.
Excellent.
This is a recipe for an Indian. How much Indian are you? All of it. Red velvet proofs deep in my solar plexus. Fry bread thighs undercooked, whipped meringue cheekbone peaks, and a blackened cut of feather tattoo marinating over childhood scars, biopsy stitches, and mole seasonings from a life of willing the cake burning inside to rise, rise, rise. This is Summer in Lorraine. Hot air balloons can only crash. It took me 15 years and 5,000 miles to watch nylon candies en flambé fall like parade cast-offs from the sky. In open fields, hands sticky with crepe drippings, the lot of us craned our necks and clutched our phones, waiting with hungry impatience for the cascade of exquisite collisions. It's home to the largest hot air balloon festival in the world.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Namesakes. My mother named me after her father she hated. Like buying Papo's notice with a fat grandchild would make up for anything. My mother named me after famous cowboys, then went and married an Indian herself. Meanwhile, her own mother said, no darker. My mom named me the second most popular girl's name in 1981, because firsts were for good girls without panic. My middle name was the same as a boy in sixth grade, with greasy nails and dirty hair, so I said it was short for Colette. My mother was a surprise 15 years too late. In the hospital, her father said, she ain't much to look at, is she? And asked the nurse to name her. The little Mexican girl chose Rita after her own child, and nobody not nowhere ever could say a pearl was an ugly thing. My mother named me for a man she despised well after his girth had gone to skeleton and the coffin flies went still, but still, I thought a namesake should mean something good and holy, like clean slates, buried shames, and starting overs. This is Passing. And when you started reading that first poem that you read, I saw some similarities. They faded quickly, but I'm
okay.
Okay.
Well, it's here.
I was 12 before I realized my father wasn't white. Until then, I thought nothing of his clay-colored skin, eyes dripping like honey, or ropes of black licorice hair snaking alive and furious down his back. My breasts sprung early, hips splayed wide as an overeager invitation, with bones pushing unforgiving against my own skin, pale and quiet as the illness. You took me to Radio Shack, your syrupy southern drawl wrapping like a shy gift around the simple words, my wife put something on hold. And the young clerk, not a decade older than me, looked at both of us with blatant disgust, loathing, and a shot of envy even I could sniff out, like a dog or a wild thing. Is this your wife? He asked. And my chest was in a painful awakening of an instant freakishly large, my hips unable to slam shut, and you, too stunned to be ashamed or anger, just whispered, that's my daughter, before walking out. The snake's gone still, but for years, I'm too sorry to take back. The years until the cancer sucked you dry, I felt it for both of us. Felt it in my thighs built like a horse and my lips too ripe for a child. In every year after labor-heavy year, I refused to be seen with you. I'm so sorry that I saw you, gut-punched and ugly as a man.
Yes, definitely moving from one mindset to another, to another. Yeah, yeah. But I see what you mean, of course.
All the ways. Know that just because we're quiet doesn't mean we aren't railing inside. We ate herring in red coats, and I told you all the ways I'd kill myself, how your lips were wilder than the moon. It's a lie that we're born alone, die alone. We arrive through slick thighs, wet bellies, and maybe we'll never see our mothers again. Maybe she'll stick to us like burned batter all our lonely lives. And we'll die with all those lovers, gone mothers, animals that licked our hurts, knotted like stowaways in the most secret, desolate chambers of our hearts. They usher us, shaking, straight into the luminous. This is my mother's remains, the apostrophe S in brackets. Do you want to go to the Bahamas? I opened my mother's ashes and was taken by the color. Somehow I thought she'd be slate, but she was like Florida, coarse and tawny. What remains is heavier than you'd think, full of bones and grit. The weight tugs you down. As I spooned her into the little glass jar, I remembered being six. My aunt packed tight in a cardboard urn while the lot of us boarded a shaky propeller plane. The pilot never said to hold it low, let the wind lap what's left. She swarmed us like wild things, left a thick coating, and we licked her chars from philtrums. Brackish and dry, she shot to our innards, became a burrowing, permanent part of us all. I thought, I don't want my mother to stay. Haunt my organs. Blow like smoke through dreams. How long can someone stick to the familiar? Cling scared to all we hate. Like the gold beggar children in Mexico, I brushed her from my skirt and held my breath against her dust. Maybe if I sprinkle her in the turquoise of the tropics, salt the rim a little more, she'll finally, after so, so many years, release those bitten nails and let me go.
Thank you.
Dawn and death in Stratford. I never held a dying thing until today. The pigeon I scooped from the roadside, its neck long and shattered. Whispering reassurances to slow-blinking eyes, I cradled the broken body in the park while life spiraled to empty. Barely dawn, there wasn't emergency vet services or anyone to watch me carry the body in a split-open Ziploc bag. Afraid to bash his head in, worried I might miss, there was nothing I could do but coo and usher him to closed eyes, stillness, but I carried his heat heavy in my palms, all the way to daylight.
A striking contrast about those two death poems right there.
I know.
Oh, pretty amazing, yeah. Please continue.
The Constellations of My Body, which is the title of my book that was released in January.
Oh. And congratulations. It's months later, but still.
Thank you.
Yes.
I flanked myself in pretty, a dressing since I had none of my own. I was always friends with the beautiful girls, the Hawaiian girl, the girl next door, the girl who killed herself. They adored me the same as children do. Toddlers demanding and wondering why I ignored their magnificence and everyone else fell awestruck at their feet. That's why I tanned the cancer into my flesh, chasing her exotic reaches, shaved my teeth to needles and cemented on porcelain, filling my mouth with bathroom fixtures. Let doctors cut me apart like a hunting prize in the filth of Central America, piece me back together, all mismatched quilt of muscle and skin. Even the lawyers say I shouldn't have survived. My silence agreed when strangers called me fat, when others said I was too ugly to bask in the company of such beauteous presence, when the old queen in London laughed, "You'll never be beautiful." And then there was you. In the frozen dermatologist's office, he taught you to sniff out cancer like a hound, the rough edges, the swirling browns. "Do you love her constellations?" he asked, and your silence said yes. The stars of my body, shooting meteors, the fallout from years in tanning beds seen for once as gorgeous in their danger. Those remote incandescent miracles dying like bright fireworks in the darkest, most secret of my nights. Mm. Red Delicious, which probably a lot of people know is a slur for Native Americans. Apple
actually,
apple
I
is.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's
I laughed because I thought, oh, it's the apple, but well, whoa.
It is the apple. Mm-hmm. It's the other apple.
Yeah.
You had a red delicious sticker plastered to your foreman badge. As a child, I didn't know apple was a bad word, the same as Oreo or Twinkie. Mm-hmm. When I asked what it meant, you just flashed those dazzling white teeth and said, it's what they call us Indians. You owned it, took pride in it, reclaimed it. What was so wrong about being something natural, something healthy that produces those strong, thick ivories, something delectable? But not you. You, my father said. You look just like your mother. God, she was beautiful in her youth, all long, thick hair flying behind the motorcycle like a wedding dress train, starved down to ant-like waste from meals of mustard and lettuce leaves. But how I wanted your toasted skin. Mine was so pallid next to yours. I craved that delicious red coloring and, as a child, soaked chestnut into my skin day after day, roasting in my mother's tanning bed, letting the cancer sink in slow, a dirty marinade that made me look like you. The ugliness didn't show till decades later, and by then you were gone, smoke. Fragments of bone burned to ashes, a lifeless gray shade boring nothing like you, and with not a trace of scarlet. The last one I'll share, I try to end on a not-so-sad note, considering my work. This is Should Whiskey Write a Love Letter Back? I love whiskey, adore everything about it. The ritual, my favorite dense tumbler, the taste that brings me back to 19. All the bad decisions rolled up neat as tombstones. I'm here for the scent of tar still clinging dumb to vinyl stools. For the dim and the din only the last bar in town without a television can muster. I love it enough to be whole with one, some nights need it to fill me all the way up. When the tour guide in Lynchburg told us, with the strong stuff, you hug the amber in your mouth, along your tongue for 6 seconds, it all made sense. My apex can tame that wandering, my body the wild, my parents birthed into me, the root of all my best failures. It asks less than a winning bull ride, the spheral purring down my throat. I had no idea the anatomy of the tongue until I had to research for this. Apex, body, root, it's very organic.
Yes, and complicated.
Yes.
And to us, it's just, you know, the tongue, you stick it out, you keep it in, it helps you chew your food. But, yeah, all the stuff about the body, when we start paying attention instead of just living as one or within one, depending on your perspective, is wildly complicated. And I, too, have been thinking a certain amount about cancer in the last several years, and it's... This is going to sound so perverse because cancer is so terrifying, but it's kind of a treat to hear someone else who's trying to do what I'm trying to do, which is to make art out of the terror and the shock of finding out and then dealing with what it means to have, as the saying goes, cancer.
I'm not sure if you've experienced this, but whenever I write about it, and I've experienced it myself, both my parents, my sister, it comes out beautiful every time for some reason. There's something about cancer that blossoms in that way.
Well, I think the verb blossoms has something to do with, you know, it grows like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that grows, you know, so much. The truth is that mine, I haven't got a lot yet, but the poems that I wrote, to my complete astonishment, like you were surprised to find beauty, mine are comic. And I was amazed. I've only done like, you know, half a dozen, maybe 10. And they range from silliness to hilarity. And I think, what is this? Is this some kind of emotional difficulty? Or, but no, it just happens. Anyway, as they say elsewhere, but enough about me. Okay, so now I get to ask you questions. You get to answer the questions. We talk. The first one. Did you read poetry, listen to poetry when you were growing up? Was poetry in your life when you were a child?
Not when I was growing up. I will give a very brief background. So I left home when I was 15. I graduated high school from an independent study program. I was not really introduced to poetry until freshman year of college, which was at Portland State.
Uh-huh. All right.
And
hometown school right here.
Yeah. And I was more fortunate than I knew, at the time at least. I'm not sure how it works now. They had some huge names coming through and reading. I got to meet Young Lee. Didn't know who he was at the time, but mm-hmm. that was my first poet love and remains so.
Ah, yeah. It's very exciting. And that is obviously one of the great things about being able to attend a college or university where they have a funded program. And these folks, just like you said, they bring them in. Yes, amazing. Good fortune for those of us who are in the audience of these folks. So when did you, let's say, first actually conceive of the notion of writing poetry yourself?
Well, it started as a freshman. I took as many poetry courses as I could. I was of the thought that you can't make any money as a writer. So my first major was English. I'm like, I'm going to try criminal justice because I've always liked horror movies, because that makes sense.
Sure. Law is part of that.
That lasted one quarter, and then I went back to English. And, you know, you're obviously workshopping them. It was workshop style, mm-hmm. and they just kind of started gathering and grew for a decade before I even thought to send anything out.
And so before you even thought to send anything out, so you were just writing stuff and warehousing it, so to speak, in the home office.
I was, and it's very cliched to say, but I was writing for me, and I still do write for me. I can't write for anybody else. But I feel like there comes a time, at least for me, that, I don't know, maybe there was too much in the warehouse. It needed to go somewhere, so that's where it leaked out to.
Okay, interesting. So when did you first have your poetry published, and how did that work? How did that come about?
I was writing a lot. I was living in Costa Rica. I know everyone thinks that sounds amazing. It was a different experience than what people think when you live there, when you live in San Jose. I was desperately wanting to come back. It's this melodramatic love story that you can read about in my book, The Wrong Kind of Indian. But that's how I've always processed, was through poetry, not just through writing, but through poetry. And I'm one of those people where I have to keep a little notebook by my bed because I'm up at 3 a.m. And no matter how many times I swear I'll remember, I don't. I'm slowly learning, sometimes 10% of the time. Mm. And there was just so much flowing out, and I was working from home, as I do now, mm-hmm. as a writer. And I just thought, maybe I'll just send this out. I think it got placed, I had poems placed in about 10 journals. And I'm like, you know, I think I have a book. I had no idea what that meant. It was 100 poems. I had two books. It got published as 100 poems. And then for my second book, through the same publisher, I asked Marvin Bell to write a blurb for it because he had selected my poem as a grad student to win an award. And he agreed, even though he said, I don't do this anymore, but I'll do it. And the letter that he wrote back to me is like, this should be two books. You know you have two books here. There's two books, right? But I thought bigger was better. It's okay.
And you got somebody to go for it in the publishing world. See, that's the part that's really important. Whether he thought you were wrong or not, whether you insisted on it or not, it got published. That's the big thing. We know this. Yeah. Okay. All right, a different kind of question. What do you think you receive from writing poetry? What does it do for you? How does it work in you?
I don't know any other way to communicate or release than through poetry. Even when I'm writing non-poetry, it comes out in a poetic way. Kind of like what I'd read in one of my poems, that words get stuck in my hands. It's hard for me to articulate orally the hard things. They just have to come out that way. So they come out as poetry, and I've found that some people resonate with that and hopefully get something from it. My favorite thing is when people come up to me and say, I thought I was the only one.
So you don't say it, you write it, but then when you perform it, you are, quote unquote, saying it.
I do not like reading my poetry. I've been told twice by two completely different people that I need to take acting lessons to perform my poetry.
Oh.
And I'm very, I feel like my poetry needs to be read. I love playing with line breaks. That doesn't come across when I kind of try to pause a little bit there. So, I mean, I guess maybe I could have taken that as an insult, but I'm not a performer.
Yeah.
I do it, but.
Yeah, well, now that I've just heard you read, I can say my vote is, yeah, you know how to do it. What's the problem to these other people who are not in the room with us as we record this show, but still. Anyway.
I think they were wanting the Shakespeare poetry, and I'm like, oh, I'm not a.
Well, even Shakespeare shouldn't really be performed that way. I remember the first time I understood that when I was, this was like 1,000 years ago, I thought, oh, yeah, that's bogus. These people are just talking. And when you can make that, his words, sound like just talking, then you know you've really gotten somewhere. And the ones who declaim it and, oh, you know, everything's like that, it's like, please, this is not what we want.
Well, I was told when I was at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, where I got to see performances on the royal stage.
Yes.
They said Shakespeare was not meant to be read.
Many people feel that way, right? And only to be performed.
Right. I mean, of course, that's going to make sense with the plays, but that kind of made me see it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And then they commissioned me to write some pieces for them, which I knew going in. And then they said, can you write about the plays you saw? I don't know about you, but it's very difficult to be commissioned to write something
specific. It's daunting, shall we say.
And it just happened that the performance I saw, Cleopatra and Antony, the very first black Cleopatra on that stage in history.
Oh.
So for me.
What a gift.
For me, I think as an American, I was experiencing a lot of things that maybe some British people didn't. She completely disrobed and she took off her wig at the end. And it was so immensely powerful. And I'm just wondering, I wonder if anybody else is having the same correlation here. So I wrote about comparing it to being a slave on the auction block.
Mm-hmm. That was actually the first image that flashed in my mind when you said that.
They didn't say what I had to write about the play I
saw. No, so. No. They said, do it. You did it. You said, why, sure, I'll do that. So, all right, I don't want to, I'm going to ask more questions. Actually, this is an interesting, like when we talked about the placement of the poems, this is a semi-segue. Are there subjects that you particularly want to write about and some and or, whichever way you want to answer this, subjects you particularly do not want to write about?
Well, as a confessional poet, I write what I'm feeling in the moment. There's nothing that's off the table for me in terms of I want to keep this private.
Uh-huh.
I think there's huge themes going through my writing of clearly someone could see the selection. Well, she was going through this right now. My mother just died 2 months ago, and everything I've written since then has been about her. Unsurprisingly.
Just so.
But with that, with, you know, the themes that arise throughout your life, they kind of edit and put together the next books themselves in that way. I just read all of Sharon Old's books, all of them in a row.
I was going to say, did you do them in chronological order?
Not everyone, but the one that really mattered, I did. Stag's Leap, where every single poem is about her divorce.
Uh-huh.
I felt that. I mean, she was living that through her words.
Yeah. You know? Yes. My thinking is, and I'm guessing you agree from what you just said, that's what she does in her poetry.
Right.
I'm, like you, one of the appreciators. All right. Are there subjects, themes, topics that you find really difficult to write about, even if you have chosen to try for it?
Not necessarily, but something that, I'm not sure how I feel about this, and I'm interviewing an artist, a visual artist, and I'm going to ask her this question too. I think it's a common question that's popped up in recent years. Do you think you have a responsibility as an artist to address certain political or likened type of issues? The answer for me is no, I don't think that's my job. but there's so much pressure externally and increasingly internally to do that. But it's hard. It's like being commissioned. So I try to write about Dakota Pipeline. I feel like I should have something to say about this because I'm an Indigenous woman, but it just didn't
happen.
It just didn't.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a difference between, in any given situation, our sense of responsibility, like what you just articulated, I ought to be able to do this. In fact, I should do this, as opposed to being seized by whatever is happening and then having it be what comes from us when we write, whether we are, and I'm like you, I keep pens, pencils, scraps of paper, stuff literally everywhere in the apartment because just in case and because I know, like what you said, I'm not going to remember this. Even as I walk from the kitchen to the other end, you know, write it down now or lose it. Yeah. So it comes for us. And sometimes we awaken to it, and other times we just, and I don't think we need to, I hope we don't, feel bad or trash ourselves when we don't rise to it. If we don't have it, we don't have it. And when we do, then there's that extra sensation of something that is more than we are, as we put it into our words, into our written words.
At the same time, I think, for me, sometimes it takes me a very, very long time to digest an experience, years sometimes, but our culture of Instagram and instant gratification, you need to write about this right now.
Yeah.
It just happened yesterday.
Right.
Some folks can do it.
Right. Yes, some folks can do it. Many people do it. But when we're talking...
Doing it well?
Yes, that's a whole nother thing, for sure. Okay. This next question is somewhat related to some of what we've already talked about. I'll ask it anyway and see if other things occur to you. Do you think of poetry... You accept, in fact, embrace the label confessional poet. Do you think of poetry as nonfiction or as autobiography? A lot of people use those terms when they're talking about poetry. Very rarely when they're talking about prose, unless it's actually labeled that on the side of the book or on the shelf in the bookstore. You know what I mean?
It can be. Mine is. I do sometimes use the word autobiographical just because a lot of people might not know what confessional means. I think it's in the title, but still I just kind of want to articulate what that is. Nonfiction, I mean, yeah, that's technically true, but I think if someone picked up this book, said, oh, this is a nonfiction book, that's probably not what they were wanting to read.
Yeah, okay. Are there other arts that you think of as being like poetry? And if not, then we'll move on. But if yes, what are they and what makes them like poetry?
Okay, this isn't an art, but yoga.
All right, we were going to get to that anyway. So say some words about that, please. I'm very interested, and I'm sure that the people listening are too.
Well, I'm a certified yoga teacher, children's yoga teacher, personal trainer, Yoga Alliance, continuing education provider. There's my spiel. And I also founded... the Get It Om movement.
Mm-hmm.
When it's within my control, and it usually is, when I teach yoga, I always end Shavasana by sharing a poem. And I love it when it's a class full of women, because then I can really, I love to do Phenomenal Woman. I never have just a class of men, so I can't really speak to that. But there's the meditative qualities, there's the entire holistic body experience with the element of spirituality in there as well. I mean, there's a lot of yoga classes or things like that that's, you know, poetry in motion is a very common and cliched term, but for a reason. it works. There's a natural alignment. There's a coming back to the earth, as, you know, hippie as that might sound.
Well, hippie, you know, the word is used and abused so much. We can, you know, I know what you mean, but yeah, I don't think there's anything negative about the way that sounds. Not at all. In a sort of cousin to those questions, have you read, studied, spoken languages other than American English?
Oh, I wish. I've tried. My husband's from India, and his mother tongue is Gujarati, although everybody in his family speaks and understands Hindi. So when I went to meet them for the first time, I knew there was no way I could learn Hindi, especially in a small time frame. So I found someone on Craigslist who was a native speaker, and I said, I just need to memorize some phrases, and this is what I want to memorize, because my mother-in-law doesn't speak English at all. And I had it down, and I was so nervous, and the initial meeting was short, you know, maybe an hour. And we were all standing outside the hotel waiting for their taxi. And I'm like, I just need to say it. And I did. It was one of my proudest moments of that trip.
And it worked well for you.
It did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not only did you memorize it, but when you wielded it, it did what you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's
it
lovely.
Did. Yeah.
And Hindi, not easy. Well, I suppose really any language that's not one's own language is not easy. So, you know, I think of the ones that whatever language you come up in, if you're working with one that has a different alphabet, then it's a whole nother ballgame. It's one thing to, you know, start with Spanish and go to English or some, you know, where we use the same alphabet and we're coming out of the same roots, linguistically speaking. But it's quite another. As soon as people are printing the stuff down the side of the page and they're turning the book in the opposite direction from whatever you learn, then it's really, really, really difficult. Or so it seems to me. Okay, now this actually came up a few minutes ago, but again, I'll ask. You said you write for yourself. Do you ever think about your audience or your readers when you're writing?
No, and I'm apparently never going to learn because, you know, I know they're in books. I know they're out there, and I'm still shocked if I get an email or something, and I'm like, oh, there's people reading this. I can't think about it because then I would start censoring, and then I would start feeling embarrassed and shamed about what I put out there. But
yeah, I'm not recommending it. I'm just asking. Yeah. And you've already talked about the relationship between the poetry and the yoga. Is there a relationship between your writing, because you also write prose, poetry or prose, and other parts of your life other than the yoga? Do you think of the writing in relation to other elements of your life?
That's kind of hard to answer because, I mean, I make my money writing, a writing services company. It's all I do all day long. It's my number one form of communication. I think it's the only way that I can portray who I am because I'm an introvert. But I consider myself quiet but not shy. And so that makes me come across as very arrogant because I'm observing constantly. I can't help it. And that's how I glean information about people, about places. So, I mean, yeah, I think I'm always in some stage of writing, no matter what I'm doing.
Even if you're not actually at the keyboard or holding a pen or pencil in your hand.
Right, because I'm observing, and those are going to probably make their way into writing at some point. I do a lot of hiking. I need to be in the forest, and that's where things can really start to come out.
Yeah. Do you find that, I'm asking this because it's an experience that I've had. Do you find that once you begin to walk, actually this can happen for me even with urban walking, but certainly in the forest or by the sea, once you've been walking for a while, things change in the way you think, even word women like us. Have you thought about that when you're thinking about your language, your use of words, and this business of being with the trees?
I don't know if it changes rather than opening up different aspects of our voice and how we're seeing things.
Mm-hmm.
It's very evident when I'm riding after I've been hiking. It's just a reconnection.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely feel when I spend long stretches of time in an urban environment, like London or Mumbai or something, I absolutely just, I need to get to the forest as soon as I get back. Mm-hmm. That's the Oregon in me.
Yeah, well, I think possibly people in other states as well have that kind of experience. I'm just guessing. If you're listening and you disagree, okay, fine.
I just came back from Montana, my first time there. And I went up to Glacier National Park.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend from there is like, you have to go to Lake McDonald. There's this hiking trail. And the water, I haven't seen it that clear since I was a child. And it made me so sad.
Yes, yes. When we have the good fortune to go to a place where things, perhaps the word pristine is no longer even valuable, but comparatively speaking, when we find something like that, yeah. Someone just said to me recently that when he was walking in old growth forest, it was like having an oxygen mask put over his face because the intensity of the, you know, literally the oxygen that they are making, that we are using. Sometimes I think if everyone really knew what trees are doing for us, they would not cut them down so mindlessly. They couldn't even begin to use them the way they use them now. But maybe I'm just, I don't know, being romantic or something. But it seems like a lock to me. If they just knew. Here's another. This is another one of the heavy political questions. And again, we've touched on some of this already, which is cool because now we have thematic threads. Do you believe, when you think about your work and yourself, that your class, race, ethnicity, national origin, sexual identity, gender, age, physical ability, you know, the whole mm-hmm. list, determine what you write?
I probably wouldn't know if it did. I don't know any different than who I am.
What an interesting answer. Yeah.
I sometimes say I'm a Cherokee poet. Sometimes I don't. I've heard that some natives and probably people from various backgrounds, I'm a poet. I'm not a Cherokee poet.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, that's every facet of my life has been informed by all of the long list of things that we present to be or are.
Similarly, of course. Yeah, that's what I think. You can't not be that. The question then is, I mean, for all of us, not just for you on this particular episode of this radio show, what do we do with that understanding? What do we make of it? Where do we use it consciously or even unconsciously, if we can figure that out, in our lives? Yeah.
I mean, for me, it has been a goal to just be as transparent and blunt and honest about my experiences as possible. The hardest thing I ever wrote was my first novel. And it's a memoir. It basically says it. There was an episode that I wrote about that was so embarrassing that I had never told anybody about before, but I went into it, like, I just need to be completely naked and put it out there.
Mm.
I will never read that chapter myself. I certainly won't read it aloud, but I felt not that... That was a time that I thought, I have a responsibility to be completely honest if I'm going to feign to even be honest at all, so...
Okay. So you quite deliberately don't perform it, as we were saying earlier, but you felt a responsibility to include it because, say some words about what was it that made you feel responsible for doing that?
I was writing a book about my upbringing, about what made me what I am, about why I am the way I am now. There was a tiny part of me, I don't write for other people, but there was a tiny part of me that thought, this is kind of something that nobody is going to admit. I can't be the only person here.
Probably not about anything. Yeah.
I felt I'd be cheating on so many different levels if I left it out.
Yeah. And actually, I think that when we recognize that we might be cheating or lying, that's not about the audience. That's about our sense of ourselves as people, not just as writers. That's what I think. Not that you asked. We spoke briefly about Sharon Olds. You mentioned Marvin Bell. Mm-hmm. Are there particular poets or even individual poems that have been useful or important or simply a delight in your life?
I really fell in love with poetry with Kim Adonisio. I feel in some ways that I've moved past that. From what she was writing about, I'm sure she's moved way past it.
No doubt.
But
no doubt.
I have as well. I still have the poem about the red dress, What Women Want. It's printed on a mirror in my bathroom next to Phenomenal Woman. Still memorized. But like I mentioned, it's Lee Young Lee, and there's something about him, especially Braiding, that is just heartbreaking every single time.
That's an interesting thing you just said. I have similar experiences for, you know, with music as well as poetry, that it's heartbreaking every single time. I deliberately go to certain mm-hmm. pieces, either musical recordings or readings, to get my heart broken.
Right.
Because I need whatever that hokey Valentine or reverse Valentine word means. Mm-hmm. You're nodding. Okay, so you know what I'm saying. So it's not masochistic. There's something about the depth of the experience that we're seeking, or so I believe. What do you think?
No, I absolutely agree. I'm not a crier mm-hmm. at all, but sometimes you need to. And for me, that's maybe once or twice a year. And when I'm just feeling I have all of this whatever inside me that needs to get out, there's a song, yeah, that I go to.
Mm-hmm.
Or even with if I can share the lines that I love, there's just two of them in there. One was, he's talking about him and his wife in grad school when they were young and taking this long bus ride to get to school and everything. And it's cold and it's miserable. And he says, how I wish we didn't hate those years while we lived them. And then later, he's talking about when they're older and they're together. And he says, one day one of us will have to remember this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Yes, a perfect example. Thank you. Okay, we have maybe a couple more minutes. So I'll ask the looking into the future questions. What are you reading now? And what would you like to say about whatever you're reading now?
Well, so right now I've promised myself I am only going to read research-based books because I'm working on a dissertation right now. And it's on female poetics in the past 200 years and the intersection of eating disorders. So that's actually why I just read Sharon Olds. She doesn't identify as having an eating disorder, but her mother uh-huh. did, and she wrote about that quite a bit.
Yeah.
I just read all of Melissa Broder, who is new, Wish. She's Twitter famous.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't even know about Melissa Broder.
Her essays.
I should look her up.
You should look her up. But look up her essays. They're
okay.
Really good. And she's agreed to meet me at the end of this month.
Excellent.
So I'm a fangirl all over her.
Okay.
Next up is Anne Sexton, all of her work.
Yes.
That's a big one coming up.
I'll say. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's true. Sharon Olds doesn't identify as having an eating disorder, nor am I saying I think she should. But food
mm-hmm.
is omnipresent.
I just went through and highlighted
not just about
every
her mother either.
Of it.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, you're on the case. Well, that's cool. All right, and what if you're going to name one, or actually more than one, aside from the dissertation work? Mm-hmm. What would you say you are working on now, as opposed to just what are you reading? And you know,
for my own professional,
yes, for your own production.
I have 3 forthcoming books.
Oh, well then, tell us about
them.
2
are coming out in autumn. One is Poetry by Unsolicited Press, and it's called Drag Me Through the Mess. The other is a prequel to my novel, You Look Something, it's that one, and that's being published by Wyatt McKenzie, publisher based in Deadwood, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one is 2019, and it's an Airlie Press book, Savagery.
Yeah, nice little selection. I, too, love being published by presses in Oregon.
Right.
The Oregon small presses have been good to me, and I love them. Well, good for you. That's a great group you've got coming out. Everyone who's listening will be able to write that down while they listen or keyboard it in and check it out. So thank you very much for visiting with us, reading to us, talking with me. And we will now say goodnight.
Thank you for listening, folks.
And wherever on this earth you are listening, be sure to support your local independent bookstores, your independent reading series, and independent radio. Good night.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pandit Ramdas Palsule Tabla Show.